everybody. You're listening to Into the Dark here on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you like the shows you're listening to, you should consider giving us some money by going to radiofreebrooklyn.com/pledge. Stick around, we got a very witchy show for you. See you on the back end of the theme music here at Into the Dark.
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
We're not always
here. The often erotic world of the witch.
You can walk the red coming back to life.
The journalist with an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey everybody, welcome to The Dark, the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We have a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about necromancy, which is raising the dead, and also doing an interview I did with poet and witch Annie Finch. And that's going to be really fun. But before we get to that, we should talk about witchcraft in the news, because witchcraft has been in the news since we last met. In the last few days, Lana Del Rey, the great and powerful musician and performer, admitted publicly that she has been attempting to hex Donald Trump using magic. Of course, she's not the only one who's been doing that. Michael M. Hughes recently led a mass ritual against Donald Trump. And if you want to hear him talk about it, I did interview him. So you can check out those past episodes on iTunes. I think the episode's called Hexing Donald Trump, and there's a picture of Donald Trump with a pentagram over his face that I put together using an online photo editing program that is not only free, but free. So that's been going on, but I'm much more interested in another instance of witchcraft in the news, and that is the saga of Matt Skiba. So, Matt Skiba, formerly of the Alkaline Trio, now in Blink 182, was part of course, Blink 182, when it pulled out of the Fyre Festival. That was that incredibly disastrous music festival with people stranded, logistical nightmare, really terrible, a few weeks back. But he came out and publicly said that he thinks he used witchcraft to hex that festival and bring it to its moment of despair. So Amp quoted him at talking about the incident, and I think it's worth just giving voice to what he said, which is that I had a bad feeling about that event. I consider myself a pagan and a witch with every inch of my energy. I wanted fire not to happen. I put all the electricity and energy in my body against that thing happening. I've been to the Bahamas before, and it's so crass. You land in Nassau, and the whole island is replete with beauty and culture, but there's a lot of poverty and is a largely black population. Then they build these places like Atlantis and the Cove that are walled off. It's classist and racist. And then they decide to park a bunch of yachts with models to show off in front of those poor people going down there with all of your Ferraris and bullshit and yachts. And so we added, we pulled out for technical and logistical issues, and the rest of it crumbled to shit because that's what it was. It was bullshit. I used my witchy ways, and it seemed to work. I'll take responsibility, and everyone can blame me. Shazam. I was on my couch feeling somewhat guilty, but very relieved that I wasn't there with people stealing from each other. I don't want a bunch of people to be marooned on Bullshit Island. I put all of my energy into it not happening, because for all the tea in China, I didn't want to be a part of something like that. So, it's kind of hard to trace the thread of what he was saying there a little bit, but it would seem to be that he didn't want it to happen at all, and it's possible that what happened is that if we attribute his magical intention, or attribute the failure of this festival to his magical intention, it's very conceivable that instead of, while he had intended to prevent it from happening at all, he simply made it this horrible shit show through the power of magic. And honestly, either of those plans seems valid. Either way seems good, because, I mean, there's a question of, like, but this does sort of bring up the question of magical intention, specifically the idea that you need to be very clear with anything you're attempting to do, anything you're hoping to have happen, because if you are not clear, it's possible that you will get a version of what you want that is in fact not what you want. Be very careful. This is where sigil magic can be very helpful for some people, because if you build a sigil off of a phrase or a sentence, you can write down with a great deal of specificity what it is you're after, and then have the sigil rooted in that. You know, not I desire wealth, but I desire for my next business venture, the cupcake factory I'm opening in Topeka, Kansas, to have great wealth and sales or something like that. Something very specific, so you can avoid the kind of monkey's paw scenario of getting a version of what you want that you don't actually want. But fair play to Matt Skiba, using his witch powers in the spirit of equality. You know, that was some witchy socialism, and that was great. So we're going to move over now to an interview I did with a poet and witch named Annie Finch. So Annie Finch is the author of a number of collections of poetry. She also does poetry one-on-one consultations, and she's been blogging for about 10 years now about being a witch and how that relates to her poetry and how that relates to the arts. And I got to meet with her in Prospect Park here in Brooklyn on a beautiful and somewhat windy day. So there's a bit of wind in this interview. There's some background noise because we were in a public place that was very loud. But I still think, honestly, it was a great chat, and I'll just get that going for you guys, and I'll see you guys on the other side. Keep listening to Radio Free Brooklyn and Into the Dark.
Well, the beauty of witchcraft is that it is so resilient that I don't think you need to take it seriously. You don't need to protect it if you don't feel like it, because it's so inevitably natural and organic, you know?
Yeah.
It's kind of like, you know, like the weeds. Like I was actually initiated as a green witch by Susan Weed, herbalist.
Cool.
And she says that, you know, when the weeds spring up all around you, it's because they know that you need them. So if a whole lot of dandelions grow around your house, then you need that kind of, you know, medicine that dandelions have. And I kind of feel like witchcraft is the same way. Like, it just grows on its own. It's like nature. It's the natural condition of humanity. I'm more and more convinced it's the natural condition of humanity. So, you know, you don't have to treat it with kid gloves and make sure it doesn't get broken, because it is the real deal.
How did you get started? Because I'm understanding that your parents had a lot of sort of spiritual stuff in the house, but like they weren't actually pushing you in any one direction or another.
Yeah, that is true. My father was very interested. He was a philosophy professor. He was very interested in the philosophy of religion. He actually started the religion seminars at Columbia. So he was very eclectic, and they did stuff with Buddhism and Taoism, and he was a Wittgenstein scholar. So there was a little of this and a little of that, and we weren't supposed to take any of it too seriously. And I think my mother was a witch without knowing it. Like, she loved all this natural stuff. Like, she would be really careful of the insects and the bugs and the spiders, and make sure that, you know, we didn't hurt them if they got in the house. And she would let us run around naked, and she would, like, she was into health food, like, way before just about anybody else. So she was really pretty earth-centered, and I think the combination of those two things, plus being a feminist, sort of set a very ripe stage for witchcraft. And then, actually, my parents both got into the goddess around the same time that I did.
Okay.
And my mother says that I was the first one. I don't know. I had left home by then, and I started reading about the goddess. And I guess I was in graduate school. And then my parents started studying with, like, Merlin Stone and doing workshops with her. And so they were sending me books, and we kind of got into it at the same time, which is fun.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you've obviously continued this.
Yeah.
Did they?
Well, My dad, not so much. I mean, he died about 20 years ago, and he, before he died, he kind of became an Episcopalian again in the last year of his life. So he was always looking for it, I think, and I think his Wittgenstein studies actually kind of opened him up more towards witchcraft and the goddess, because it was about the spirituality and everything, and just not letting the mind have too much power, but letting intuition and paradox have their sway. So I think, you know, in that way, but he didn't, neither of them ever practiced it. And my mom, she's 96 now, and she's lost a lot of her memory, but I think she did continue it, but not very actively. But she did it like in a very personal way, like she had a pentacle she wore most of the time until she wore it into her first old age home, and then I think some of my siblings told her it was a little too strange, she should take it off. But and for a long time she signed all her letters like 9989 instead of 1989 or 1999. She put the extra 8,000 years on there, just showing that it was the year of the goddess. So she was very stubborn in these little ways, but, you know, in an idiosyncratic way. Whereas I think I'm the only one who really flew with it in terms of, you know, community and practice and really getting very conscious of it. But it's nice to feel that they share it with me, yeah. And to some extent.
That is wonderful, actually. So were you able to find like community spaces sort of outside of your family as well when you were first exploring this? Because I feel like you didn't formally come out of the broom closet until 2009
or 10, yeah, with my blog. So the first time I met an actual witch, the first time I met an actual witch, which was 1990 or 1989, when I was living in San Francisco, and I had written, I had already been like exploring goddess stuff, and I had done some stuff with my poetry and dance and music that was ritual theater with candles, and it was clearly goddess spirituality in action, but I hadn't gotten really conscious about ritual yet. And then I ran into a witch there, a wonderful witch named Francesca de Grandis. And she was teaching the fairy path. She had worked with Victor Anderson and Cora Anderson. So she was holding the Wheel of the Year rituals. So I went to her Lammas thing and just kind of sat in on it. And that was when I first opened my eyes to the fact that you could actually really live this way.
Yeah.
You could actually do ritual, and that you could get other people involved, and that it wasn't just an artistic inspiration, but it could actually be a way of life. So that was so exciting for me. And so I did that, and then Francesca and I did some ceremonies together, and she did a ceremony for my babies, my baby when he was born. I had a little seed of it, and then I moved from my first job to Iowa, in this little town in Iowa, and I discovered a really great like earth spirituality group that met in the basement of the Unitarian Church every week.
That's awesome.
It's incredible. So that was the first time that I really did the whole Wheel of Years with that group. And it was fantastic. It was really great. The woman who was there, she used to live in the Northwest, and she'd been in Iowa, and she just knew her shit really well. So I just got a really good grounding in the basic principles of the Wheel of Year and Cone of Power and kind of Witchcraft 101, Starhawk variety. It was just great. And what really clinched it for me was that I didn't like the poetry very much. You know, there was some sort of ritualistic writing that people would read aloud. And
right, the sort of rhyming
some
spells
of it,
and such.
Some of it was rhyming spells, and a lot of it was just kind of prosy, you know, kind of reverent sounding prose. At this time of the year, when the goddess is da 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 da, and the wheel of the year turns, men we must blah blah blah. It was just so like pretentious and not that relevant. And then
we hearkened unto thee.
Yeah, there was that too, exactly. Yeah, that whole gardener wicker type of protection. I couldn't stand it, so I offered to write a series of poems for the wheel of the years. And so I did, and we used them. So I would write them, and then we would use them like the next week or whatever. And that was incredibly helpful to get them in action and see how they worked and get feedback and change them. And I decided to do a different meter for each one. So that became the skeleton of the book calendars.
Right.
And when I first put that book together, I thought I didn't know what to do with them because they were so different from the other poems, and I had them all bunched together in the back.
Yeah.
And then it was Carolyn Kaiser who looked at the book and said, this is the best thing in here, you should make that, you know, you should spread them through the book. And then I got the idea to make them the whole structure. So that really was an important thing for me because I've been a poet my whole life, and being a poet has been my central spiritual path. So when I realized that this beautiful spirituality that I was discovering needed my poetry, I also discovered that my poetry needed it, and that it would be this incredible opportunity to, you know, to create something that would be useful for other people, and also to just open up this door to this incredible wealth of inspiration. So ever since, that's been like my central thing as a poet. This is just unendingly exciting to work with. It's wonderful. So, and then, yeah, and there were a few other stages too. I'm actually writing a book about this now, a memoir.
How is that coming along?
Interesting you should ask, because it's been a long process to get to this point. I think I started working on it about 7 years ago. I wrote an 80-page prospectus, which almost got published at Viking Penguin, and then didn't make it, and abandoned the whole thing, and wrote another book instead, which is the book that is now hopefully going to find a publisher right away. My agent has it out. It's called The Witch in You, Five Directions to Your Inner Goddess. So that's like a practical manual for witchy living for an average person. So I got that all out of my system, and now I'm going back to the memoir. And it's been kind of, you know, boggling, because unlike a lot of memoirs that only tell about one period of your life or, you know, one sort of thing that happened, this really, in order to do it right, I think it has to basically tell my whole life story.
Yeah.
So how to do that and not just get all over the place, and I love structure. So it was actually last night that I came up with structure that I'm really feeling great about, that I think I'm going to structure it around the five sacred directions.
Okay.
The same way that my Wish in You book is structured. And actually, I lived at different points in my life. I grew up in around New York, so that's east. I spent a lot of time in northern Maine, that's north. And then I went to Texas and California, that's west. I was in Cincinnati, which is about as far south as I ever really want to go. And, you know, then the center is everything. So, like, my whole life is going to fit in this structure. And I think it's starting to really work. So, I'm excited. Yeah.
That's so great. Going all the way back, though, for a second. So I've read somewhere on the internet, that you, in many ways, or in some ways, trace your sort of line back to Celtic and Norse bards. Do you feel like do you feel a strong connection to those traditions, or?
I do. I mean, genetically, I have that lineage. My mother's probably at least half Scandinavian, which I didn't even know until we did Ancestry.com, and then I discovered it through her saliva, and the Celtic on both sides. And I do, and largely it's because of the connection between the poetry and the spirituality.
Right.
because and both of them also had very clear roles for women. I mean, women were key in all of this. So, like, in Iceland, I was just in Iceland a couple of years ago, and the women were really very strong, central part of all this. And there were these women called Volvas, V-O-L-V-A, which may be connected to the word vulva. And they were like the seers, the prophetesses. And they would tell poems, they would share their visions in poems, and they were really channeling for the tribe. So that's the role that I see myself increasingly trying to carve out and embrace for myself as a poet. But I was a professor for a long, long time and wrote a lot of books about poetics, and for the last 4 years I've been away from a steady teaching job, and I'm really trying to find a job that's like a job to actually be a poet in the world.
Mm.
And I mean a poet in the sense of channeling spiritually what needs to be said, and using structure to make language do the work that will help us to remember our way and
right.
connect us with Earth and connect us with our best selves. So, Yeats is a model for me in this. I feel that he really did that. Yeah, Langston Hughes is another poet that I feel took that on. And I feel that where we are right now in the world, the power of women, the power of the goddess, and for me witchcraft is very much connected to that older way of being where women's power is central to the community, and it's a matriculture, basically.
Right.
The opposite of a patriarchy, a matriculture. And I think that's where the developed world has to go back to.
Yeah.
Where the rest of the world already is there. They never left, but the developed world left, and we have to get back there fast to save the planet, really, to save our species, to save everything. So, that's kind of my ambition as a poet, is to be that for the matriculture. To be the voice of the tribe, and to just write poems that people will enjoy and be able to use in their lives. So I feel connected to the Norse in that way, and the Celtic as well. And another thing that really connects me to the Celtic tradition is just the use of structure and meter and form. I mean, they had hundreds of meters that they would use in their training, and we're barely scratching the surface, but for me that's that kind of rhythmical discipline is so important as a way to open a channel for the work that I'm going through to do.
Do you ever so for me at least, I find like part of what makes formal poetry seem more somehow gives it a spiritual character is the sort of the physical aspect of going through meter and allowing your body to sort of be as much an instrument of the poem as your mind, your voice is.
Exactly. Okay. Exactly. It brings you all together. And I have this tattoo I have on my arm here. It's my poetry witch medicine shield. And it has these five colors and these five directions. And over the years, I've been working with what I call metrical diversity for 30 years or so. And at this point, I've got each of these represents, in the sacred circle, represents a direction, an energy, an element, all the different aspects that go with the circle. And I have a meter that goes with each of those as well.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm developing a system I call the healing spiral of rhythm, where people work with these different meters in this order, and it's counterclockwise, moonwise, which a lot of witches go clockwise, but I feel much better when I go moonwise, and so I'm always try to do that when I can. So we work moonwise, so east, north, west, south, center. And when you do that and you write in the meters in that order, it can be unbelievably transformative and cathartic. Even if you haven't written poetry before, if you write about your issue in that sequence, it really works. And so I feel like I've got it down now, and I've been, you know, playing with it for a couple of decades, trying to, especially the last decade, trying to get the order right and the meters and which one goes with which. And if you look at my book calendars, I was doing something similar in this poem called In Bulk Dance, where I had a different meter for each direction, but a couple of them were mixed up and they were wrong. And so now I finally got it.
So is there somewhere people can go and sort of find the system that you've worked out? Or
I'm writing a book somewhere along when I finish the memoir, or around the end of it, I'm going to write a book called The Healing Spiral of Rhythm, and it's all going to be in there.
Okay,
and
cool.
I also teach workshops. So you can people can sign up for my newsletter at poetrywitch.com and or anniefinch.com or poetrywitch.com, and they'll be able to get the information of when I do the workshops and when that book comes out.
You also do consultations with people, right? Like one-on-one kind of things?
I do. I do one-on-one poetry teaching, and I also do, like, I can write poems for people that I like, do, like, a shamanic journey, and then I come back with, like, a talisman and the right rhythm for that person. And then they can carry, you know, they can frame it or have that talisman. So I do that as well. But, yeah, I do a lot of individual poetry teaching.
How much does shamanistic practice play into your just overall spiritual practice and such?
It's, in a lot of ways, it's the foundation of it. I mean, I feel that that is the original religion, and that's where all the stories and myths come from. So, yeah, even when I don't, I mean, when I first got into shamanism, actually, it was around the same time that I met Francesca de Grandis. That same year, I worked with a shaman named Fred Tejan in San Francisco, and it was really amazing. And, you know, since then, I like to do it with a real drum. I'm not, you know, and I like to be with friends, so I'm kind of picky, like, I don't like to just go to any circle. But, so I don't do it very regularly, because I don't have those conditions, I haven't set up those conditions yet.
Right.
But I feel like that training is almost the basis of everything that I do anyway. And even writing poetry, like the state of mind that I get into when I'm writing, and the meter functions as a sort of a drum, and it has especially these five rhythms I like to work with. I have other rhythms I like to work with as well, five main ones. So really it's a very similar process, except that instead of actually envisioning things happening, or, you know, envisioning things visually, or like a movie, or like, you know, like being in a dream or whatever, like a real shamanic, like quote, real shamanic journey, it's just opening myself for the words to come in. So it's kind of a shamanic journey in the darkness of the words.
Sorry, that phrase was great.
Yeah, it's because of the meter. A shaman journey in the darkness of the words. The darkness of the words. It's iambic.
Yeah. I guess it's sort of, you know, in that way, meter can also be like magic, because it's the structure of things under what is more sort of obvious. The things we sense,
right,
without necessarily perceiving explicitly or directly.
That's what's always blown me away about meter. And even before I was a witch or anything, that's what I loved about poetry from day one. And when I did my dissertation at Stanford, it was about exactly that. It was about the underlying wordless rhythm underneath the words, and just the ineffable magic of that. And I wasn't, you know, that was before I was a witch, I was writing that, but when I look back, it was clearly that exactly what you were just describing.
Yeah. It's, so back a moment to your journey for a sec. So you sort of came out to the world on your blog in around 2009, 2010, and at the time you said pagan spirituality, or the pagan, that there's a pagan spirituality that underlines your work, and it's the idea of poems as incantations heard with our bodies as well as our minds that link us with the sacredness of nature and each other. And I can't read my own handwriting, and that's something I need to work on as a person for later.
<Me too. laughs>
But do you still basically feel that way about things being about 8 years on?
I think so. Would you read it one more time?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean,
Pagan spirituality that underlies my work, the idea of poems as incantations heard with our bodies as well as our minds that link us with the sacredness of nature and each other. I feel exactly that way still.
Perfect.
Has not changed at all. Yeah.
Well, that's good. Have other things? I mean, I assume more people now reach out to you as sort of an emissary of paganhood and witchcraft.
More, yeah. I mean, I haven't published the book yet, The Wish in You, the book that I have just finished. So I think when that comes out, it'll happen even more. Yeah. But, yeah, they do, actually. There's more going on, and then there's more interest and need, yeah, which I love. And, you know, it's been interesting for me having the poet thing and the witch thing.
Yeah.
And it seems as if my whole life I always had two things. Like, for a long time, it was scholar and poet.
Mm.
And that was when I was getting my PhD or whatever. It was, sometimes I would have these identity crises because it was hard for me to see how they could be together.
Right.
And now that's not even an issue. It's, like, not a problem. That all gets lumped together as part of being a poet. And now I have brought in this other thing, the witch. But it's really, they're much closer than I would have thought, because there is such an age-old connection between the poet and the witch, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just like the shaman or the healer, poetry is often a part of that role. And I go, like, last month I was at two different conferences. One was a women's spirituality conference where I was dealing with this witchy rhythm teaching, and then another was a poetry conference, and I really felt like I was the same person at both. It felt really good. I was like, okay, I think I'm at a place now where people can reach me from different directions, and I'll be able to work with them and not feel that I'm leaving different parts of me behind anymore.
Yeah.
It's a good feeling.
I mean, to actually be fully yourself in every moment.
Yeah.
I feel like we don't really get to do that in society to some extent. There's so much compartmentalizing on the way.
Yeah, I think you have to create your own systems in order to do that.
Yeah.
And it's partly because now I'm freelance, like I don't have a university job.
Mm.
It makes it easier to feel that way. But yeah. It's a long process, and it's sad, but it's such a big deal.
Yeah.
Just to simply be yourself. Yeah. Industrialization.
Yeah.
So, right? The assembly line feeling.
Yeah. That whole, the reification and animalization of
right.
the individual is, I mean, I think that's why we need spirituality like this now more than we have in so long, just because we need to bind ourselves to each other and to nature.
That's right. Yeah. And to be able to make our own rituals, like you were describing earlier, how, you know, there were, when you felt you needed some sort of transformation or healing, you just created a ritual to make it happen.
Yeah.
And that's what my book, The Witch in You, really aims to do, is give people the tools, an array of tools to do that at any time, because that's another thing we've compartmentalized away. We've compartmentalized spiritual power off into these institutions that are separate from ourselves. And, you know, it's fine to be able to heal and help each other in a very organic way.
Yeah.
But that's different from saying, you know, spirituality only happens in this place or at this time. And only those people can do it.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And when you go back, you know, not that long into human history, it was all part of the same thing, right?
Yeah.
And dance and eating and cooking and theater and poetry and music, they were all part of spirituality.
Yeah.
Most people still live that way on the planet.
Yeah, and there was no sectioning off of things. I don't know, I'm sorry, I've been reading this book that was recommended to me by somebody of Mikhail Bakhtin's theories of the Carnivalesque.
Yeah, I remember that.
And like he makes this point of the idea that like there was a period where when you had these mass rituals, there was no sense of being the audience to something. You were always very much inside of and affected by whatever was going on.
Yeah, you're part of it. And that's the beauty of being a witch. I mean, I don't know any other spiritual path where, you know, I can just dance. I love to dance. You wouldn't know that I'm a broken ankle right now, but I love to dance. And, you know, you can just do that, and that's part of the spiritual experience. I mean, it's like, why shouldn't everyone get to do that if they want to?
So the release from shame is such an important thing.
Yeah.
But that might be just the New England in me talking.
No, it sounds like that's the ex-Catholic in you talking. But ex-Catholics make really good pagans.
I mean, hi. Yeah. I'm trying at least.
Yeah. So it's an exciting time, I think, because it seems more within reach than ever before.
Yeah.
Liberation, including spiritual liberation. And for me, the witchy path is like, it encompasses kind of everything. Like in this Witch in You book, it's divided into 5 sections, 1 for each direction, and then each direction has all 5 directions in it.
Yeah.
So it's like a spiral of 25 things. And it's got everything in there. Like it's got cooking, it's got feng shui, it's got sex, it's got dancing, it's got creativity, it's got, you know, water and fire and celebrating the wheel of the year and ritual and just, you know, kind of, and colors, clothes that you put on, the colors they have, and, you know, just everything. Like, it's all got a space in this spirituality, because our whole life is that.
Alright. Okay. Something about just like little kids in the summer just makes you feel good about everything.
It does. I love how that kid didn't even cry.
No, not at all.
It's awesome.
Wait, how long have I been doing this? Okay, cool. So you've got this platform right now in the form of this microphone and where you're speaking to possibly tens of listeners at any given time. If you had sort of like one thing you really wanted to give as advice to people who are on this journey, they're interested in these things, like beyond everything you just said already, and the book that is coming out that I'm sure will be a wonderful resource, and you know, I'll tell everybody about it the second that that's...
Yay, the Witch in You!
I'll be shouting to the rooftops about that. But if there's sort of like a big sort of nugget to give to somebody right now, what would that be?
It would be always, always go in the direction that feels good.
Mm.
Pleasure. God has said all acts of joy and pleasure are my rituals.
Mm.
And I think that's the key. So, you know, if it feels bad in any direction, it's not right. You know, I've had some amazing experiences that I'm going to write about in the memoir, involving life after death and things like that. And so I'm very certain now that life is a gift, that it's supposed to feel really good, that it's joyful. It should be joyful, you know, pretty much in every moment, no matter what's happening. There could be a way to feel joy, and that's what it's for. And, you know, so any path that makes you feel just more grateful and joyful, that's the way to go.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for this. This has been great.
Thank you.
Many thanks to Annie Finch for talking to me about all that. And God, that was such an enjoyable conversation, especially because we were in the park. And that's the thing, like, I wanted to like preserve some of the background noise because it was just nice to sit and talk about witchcraft and poetry and like the way these things connect with the body and with nature in the midst of so much nature and so much life. There were just so many people going by. Just a really wonderful moment, and Annie Finch was great to talk to. You should check out her website AnnieFinch.com. Check out her blog, Poetry Witch. And so she's got a new and selected collection of poems called Spells that came out from the Wesleyan Poetry Series, worth checking out. And when her memoir, The Witch in You, comes out from a publisher, hopefully very soon, we'll definitely, you know, we'll keep you in the loop about that here at Into the Dark on Radio Free Brooklyn, which is what you're listening to right now. But like, we'll keep you in the loop on that. And I'm sure, I mean, she's got a great Twitter account. So if you follow her on Twitter, you can also like find out about, presumably about the book there as well. So like, and that's a good move. Follow her on Twitter. You can also follow me on Twitter if you want, at Cooper Wilhelm, because actually that's a great way to get in contact with me about questions, in terms of the sort of listener questions we answer here about things like, is the St. Louis Arch an occult structure? Can you do a magical spell to make someone impotent? These are just examples of things we've talked about before, but like, I'm actually researching, or I'm like in the midst of looking into the most recent listener question. So hopefully in the next episode, 2 weeks from now, I'll be able to give you a good answer on the relationship between mental health and magic, the ways in which magic can be used to increase your mental health, the way in which your mental health might affect your ability to effectively or successfully do magic. And that was submitted to our research department, and that is being researched. And we'll be able to do that in 2 weeks. But if you have a question, please do either contact me on Twitter at Cooper Wilhelm or contact us at intothedark@gmail.com. That's intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, excuse me, because you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. But since we don't have a question to answer this week, because I'm still looking into stuff for that one I mentioned, I figured, so I, Catlan Books, which is a witchcraft, like, one-stop shop in Brooklyn, did a colloquium yesterday where a bunch of speakers spoke about the relationship between death and the occult. And I gave a lecture that I was very excited about, which was about various techniques for raising the dead, because that's a thing that I have researched fairly heavily. So I had a book of poetry come out last year called Klaatu Ferrata Nikto that was mostly about breakups and Walt Whitman, but was also about necromancy. And so I some of the techniques I talked about in that talk, it was a practical talk. It was like, what would you do if you wanted to raise the dead? What are some ways of going about that? And some of that filtered into this book of poems. But I figured I would give you guys a shorter version, because we don't have a ton of time. But I'd give you a shorter version of what I did there on the show today. And the thing is, like, if you want to learn more about this, once again, just reach out. Because, like, this show, it's a resource for the community. And I would be happy just to point anybody in the direction of some good resources, some good texts for this. Because the thing is, like, necromancy is held to be the darkest of the dark arts. It is the most sinister. It is the most forbidden. And honestly, frankly, like, looking into it, it's one of the most difficult and unpleasant forms of black magic. Like, it's not, like, super fun to do. So, like, a lot of the talk that I gave was sort of an attempt to discourage people from even attempting necromancy, because it's not, of all the ways you would do it, just aren't that great. So let's talk for a minute. So, like, necromancy is essentially either trying to raise the dead, or at least summon a particular dead person to talk to them, often by trying to put their soul temporarily back into their body, or at least visiting their body to achieve this. And the thing about this is, like, you know, there are a lot of ways to try to talk to the dead. Mediums are one. Seances, those exist. And you can also, I mean, like, if you want to, you can go use a Ouija board. I don't recommend Ouija boards. A lot of the people I've talked to who are in the know about Ouija boards and the like say they are dangerous. You don't really need to talk to the people. Like, the thing is, like, the impression I have is that, like, a Ouija board, the same people who would talk to you through a Ouija board are the same people who would try to start a conversation with you at a bus stop, but, like, not in a friendly way, in a sort of, like, they need to tell someone about what the government is doing, etc. But it's just that they're dead, and so it's the ghosts of that. I mean, though, you do hear stories on the other side. I mean, I heard a story about a woman who since became a rabbi, who said that she was told that the, like, three-year-old little sister that she was supposed to be watching while she was using the Ouija board with her friends was choking, and she ran to the other room, and she saved her sister's life because she was told by a ghost about that. But if you want to talk to somebody specifically, this is where necromancy comes in. Because necromancy, like, actually, there are a lot of, like, so the historic motivations for attempting necromancy involve things like, one is simply information, because it was understood, like, in, or was widely believed in medieval or Renaissance Europe, that the dead had knowledge that the living did not possess. That if you, once you died, you sort of understood, you knew the future, you knew the past. And so, like, if you consulted really any dead person, but maybe one with a particular connection to something, they would be able to tell you what might happen in the future, and also, like, the location of, say, buried treasure or something like that. But there are, of course, other motivations for necromancy, meaning, like, just wanting to talk to somebody you miss, honestly. Like, that's a nice one. Or, actually, I came... So there's a text from Egypt that I'm not going to get into because it's gross, but, like, the basic premise is, like, you would use necromancy to seduce somebody because you would summon a dead person back into the realm of the living specifically just to harass somebody that you wanted to seduce. Like, you would just, like, you would make it so, like, they could not have any sexual pleasure with anybody but you, which is horrifying and not a thing I would recommend. And also, yeah, so I would never... So the thing about necromancy is, like, it's the darkest of the dark arts, it's very dangerous, and it's also a lot of the things you would have to do for necromancy are generally illegal. So, like, we don't recommend here at Into the Dark or Radio for Brooklyn that you do any of this for both legal reasons, and also I don't want you to go through the trouble. Though, if you do attempt one of these methods and you do successfully raise a dead person, please do contact us at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, and we'd be happy to interview you about that. But, so, with all these disclaimers of don't do this, it's a bad idea, you shouldn't do this, I'm not telling you to do this, no one's telling you to do any of this, here's what you would do if you wanted to do this. So, this method comes from a British occultist named Ebenezer Sibley. And Ebenezer Sibley was sort of part of the, I think, larger sort of Victorian attempt to revive the medieval and Renaissance occult practices. And it's hard to say what his source text was for this. It's probably the Grand Grimoire, or at least in part the Grand Grimoire. But basically, this is a form of sympathetic magic. You're trying to connect with the dead by basically making yourself as dead as possible. So for the 9 days before you actually attempt to raise the dead, you need to try to achieve a state of maximum gloom. And by that I mean you need to dig up the clothes of a dead person and wear those, wear only the clothes that have been worn by the dead, or at least the clothes of the dead, perform funeral rites for yourself, and then observe certain dietary restrictions. So you can't eat salt, because it's a preservative. It's like it's a lot of symbolic stuff. You can't eat salt because it's a preservative. You shouldn't eat leavened bread or fermented juice. Drink unfermented grape juice, because these are things that don't have this sense of life to them. And also, the only meat you're allowed to eat is dog. And I think part of the reason is because that's honestly just kind of like really goth and scary, but also because dogs are related, are sort of associated with Hecate, the goddess of witchcraft and of the dead. I mean, of course, dogs have always been sort of supposed to be, I mean, like, if, like, ancient Greece, Cerberus supposedly was a three-headed dog that guarded Hades. And also, you're supposed to not look at women ever at all in these 9 days. Because, sexism. So, that's just the prep work, though. So once you've actually, once you've done that, on the night of, and it's better to do a night where the weather is very bad, because apparently it's just easier for ghosts and the dead to come through to the realms of the living, supposedly, on nights of dramatic and vicious weather. The thing to do is to draw a magic circle around the grave. And, like, you know, a traditional magic circle, I mean, there are different ways of doing this. One of the methods I'm familiar with is, like, you would draw two circles, actually. One that's about 9 feet in diameter, and then another that's 8 feet in diameter. In the space between those two circles, you would do a number of magic symbols. You can use chalk, or, like, a lot of people talk about doing it with, like, something pointy, like a sword or a dagger. But once you've done that, you need to burn an incense of henbane, hemlock, saffron, aloes, wood, mandrake, and opium. Once again, so, like I was saying, necromancy. Most of the ways you would do this, illegal, very illegal, because here you're presumably illegally exhuming a body, and then also you need opium, which, I mean, it's illegal, but frankly, it's getting easier to get all the time. Thank you, pharmaceutical companies. Anyway, so once you burn the incense, take out the body from the grave, arrange it with the head facing toward the east and have the body in the position that Christ was on the cross. So arms out, legs together. And in the right hand of this body, put a dish. And in that dish, put wine, mastic, and sweet oil. And then take your wand. The source I was looking at didn't specify what kind of wand, but the traditional sort of thing to make a wand out of is hazel wood. Tap the body 3 times, unless it was the death by suicide, and then I think you have to tap it 9 times. And then you say to this dead body, "By the virtue of the holy resurrection and the agonies of the damned, I conjure and command thee, spirit of..." Name of the person. "Deceased, to answer my demands and obey these sacred ceremonies on pain of everlasting torment. Berald, Berowald, Balben, Gab, Bagor, Agba, arise, arise, I charge and command thee." And the thing is, like, those sort of magic-y words in the middle there, Balban, Gab, Bagor, Agba, I was looking into those, and I'm not entirely sure where they come from. Agba is the name, or was the name, of a fortress in Judea. So, I mean, there's something to be said for, I think these are mostly old Hebrew words. I'm not entirely certain about that. But once you've said that, presumably the spirit of this dead person will return to their body and answer the questions you have or do the things you need them to do. And then you're supposed to sort of reward the dead body by burning it afterwards. Because the idea is, like, by burning it, you're ensuring that this person will never have to go through the pain and or presumably the pain and indignity of being raised from the dead again. Because just think about, like, if you were put back in your body after it started to decompose and how just unpleasant that would be. I mean, I find it unpleasant being in my body a lot of the time, and I'm still very much alive. Anyway, so that's one method. Another method is that's, like, less gross but more expensive is called the Bell of Gerardius. And so this was found in plans in the library of the arsenal in Paris. And it's supposedly from 1730. And the idea is you would make a bell. And the thing about this is, like, so that previous method is sort of sympathetic magic, right? You're trying to sort of get in touch with the dead and sort of meet the dead at their level to a certain extent, which touches back sort of on perhaps the shamanistic roots of these sorts of things. But with the Bell of Gerardius, we're talking about astrological magic. We're using astrology. So, like, the bell would be made of an alloy of the various metals that are associated with the various astrological planets. So lead for Saturn, tin for Jupiter, iron for Mars, copper for Venus, gold for the sun, silver for the moon, and fixed mercury for Mercury. And it needs to be, they need to be sort of joined together at the day and hour of the birth of the person who's going to use it. So basically you need to get this on your, can you get this done on your birthday? So happy birthday to you. I mean, it's going to be expensive, so, like, consider it a birthday present to yourself. And so you need the date and time of your birth carved into, I think, the handle. And then you need the names of the spirits associated with the planets also carved into the bell. So Eratron for Saturn, Bethar for Jupiter, Phalig for Mars, Ok for the sun, Hageth for Venus, Ophiul for Mercury, and Fuel for the moon. And you also need to have carved in the bell the Hebrew Tetragrammaton, which is the sacred name of God. Also carved in, you'll have Adonai and Jesus, just those names. And then once this incredibly complex bell is constructed, you should wrap it in green taffeta and leave it buried in the grave of the person that you want to raise for 1 week. The idea being that it would sort of take in the energies and vibes of this dead person. And then once you want to raise the dead, you take the bell out and you, while also holding a parchment with the signs of 7 planets, you ring that bell. And that's, you know, that's it. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's expensive, it's time consuming, but it's not nearly as bad as that other one. Actually, so, like, one of the worst ones I found is this one, which involves demonology, and it's from a grimoire called The Red Dragon, which is very much a sort of demonological, infernal, almost, like, grimoire. It's a lot of, like, hailing Lucifer, etc. And this is also the most complex method. And honestly, actually, you know what? If anybody wants to hear this really complex method, because we're running out of time faster than I like to admit. So if you want to hear the really complex bad method, I'll give you, like, a short overview. But if you want to hear more about this, somebody contact me either at Twitter or at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com. And I'm happy to give you the full thing in detail, either on a future episode of the show, or I can just, like, email it to you. Because that's the thing about this. It's like, I'm a person. I'm a real person. I check my email. I'll email back. It's a thing I do. It's happened before. It'll happen again. Which is also the thing about a lot of these questions, actually, is that if you submit like a research question, we will never identify who you are. We will never leave identifying information to you know, so like this is a safe space for you to learn. But, you know, if you specify that you only want me to do research for you and never put it on the show, I am willing to do that. It might just take a bit longer because I do have to put these shows together once every fortnight, which is, hey, you know, it's fine. It's whatever. But anyway, so this version that's from the Red Dragon that's so complicated involves digging up the corpse with your bare hands in the dead of winter. Like, that is step one. And so, like, that's already, like, I don't know about you, but personally, I would consider step one already the point where I tap out for that. But supposed to do that. You have to then attend Christmas Mass. You have to run back to the grave. You have to take a very specific number of steps. You have to kneel holding the femur bones of this corpse in St. Andrew's Cross over your chest, waiting for the sun to rise. Like, it is a very complex and frankly, labor-intensive and unpleasant way to do anything. And when also this one comes with the caveat that if you don't get every step completely right, you're damned forever, supposedly, which is weird because I feel like all of this stuff is bad anyway, so you should be damned for it. I mean, given this sort of like my understanding of how Christianity works is that these are all sort of damnable offenses either way, but apparently if you get it wrong, you're really in the stuff there. We're basically out of time, so I can't really go into that one in detail. And there are, like, a few more of these. Like, necromancy sort of got updated and got easier as time went on. And so I want to just briefly touch on a few things just because they're interesting and I feel like they'd be really fun. Once again, any of this, you want me to go into more detail in a future show, you just need to contact me on Twitter or email me at intothedarkrfb@gmail.com, and I'm happy to talk about these in detail. There was a senator named Shields, and in 1854, he submitted a petition to the U.S. Senate asking for funds to do research into the possibility of developing a wireless telegraph into the realm of the dead, or using telegraphic technology to contact the dead. And this petition had 13,000 signatures, including the signature of the former governor of Wisconsin, Nathaniel Talmadge, who in his retirement had become a devout spiritualist. This is when spiritualism was a huge thing in the United States. Table rappings were huge. Seances were huge. Abraham Lincoln held a seance in the White House. Like, this was a big thing. And so, like, this petition was formally presented to the Senate. And this is around the time that Samuel Morse was also asking for money to develop the infrastructure necessary for telegraphs, which is why this was done, because it was basically like, well, if he can build a telegraph to Philadelphia, why can't he build one to talk to my dead aunt? And, like, that logic makes a certain kind of sense, I guess. But, like, this was made fun of in the Senate in a very rude manner, and they did not get the money, and that is too bad, but I can go into more detail on that. I can also go into more detail, if you want to, on the Phillips experiment, where the former chairperson of Mensa in Canada, and a mathematician and a psychologist, and also a heating engineer, I think they just sort of used whoever was around. There was also a bookkeeper and accountant, because those are different things, though I don't know what the... Anyway, we're running out of time. Point is, they wanted to do a seance to a person who had never existed. So they created the biography for a fake British aristocrat who had killed himself because of a loveless marriage, and then they tried to contact him via a seance, and you wouldn't think that would work, but guess what? Sort of did. To some extent. They claimed the table. Oh, we are way out of time. Okay, so thank you for listening to The Dark here on Radio Free Brooklyn. Have yourself a fine weekend, and if any of you actually try necromancy, please do contact us. Even if you don't, make it work. Even if it's not successful, because it's all about the journey.